Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
I'm going to talk about vaccine refusal, and I think that there are few other areas or topics that are so polarising and emotive, and I hope to share some of my stories of the conversations that I've had with parents. I'd really like to talk to you about why parents choose not to vaccinate their children, and hopefully share my passion with you about how we can communicate better with these parents and really start to understand why they think the way they do. Might go back actually just for a sec before we get to that. I am sure that I'm speaking to the converted in this audience in terms of, I assume the majority of you are pro-vaccine, although really I probably shouldn't assume that. But nevertheless, in all of your fields of work, I'm sure that you have encountered challenging conversations with parents who either refuse to vaccinate or are selectively vaccinating their children, or you've had very emotional discussions with family or friends. Could I ask people to put up their hands if they have had a challenging conversation with a parent who doesn't want to vaccinate their child? Absolutely. So I think that absolutely illustrates the point that no matter what field of medicine or healthcare you work in, this is something that we all encounter. We encounter it in general practice, in emergency rooms, in paediatric outpatients on the ward. But I guess, tragically, certainly myself personally, I have encountered this in the intensive care setting where a child is admitted with a vaccine-preventable disease such as meningococcal meningitis, pneumococcal pneumonia or septicemia. And sometimes these parents are confronted with the devastating consequences of their decision not to vaccinate their child. And that can be a very, very challenging situation for us as healthcare providers and obviously them as parents. But I've also worked in an immunisation clinic at the Royal Children's Hospital now for over 10 years. And every Tuesday morning, I speak with parents who have chosen not to vaccinate their children. I've certainly developed a repertoire of approaches to communicate with these families. And it's definitely fueled my passion to try and do this better and to understand why parents think the way they do. So let's stop and take a moment to think about how parents think and interpret their fears about vaccines. We all have fears that we hold deeply, and I think similarly, most people in this room at some point would have been fearful about being attacked by a shark in the ocean. Or ever-present fear about potentially being in a plane when it and potentially having it crash. But what is the actual risk of these events happening? Well, you may be surprised to hear that the actual risk of being attacked by a shark in the ocean is 1 in 11.5 million, and the risk of dying in a plane crash is about 1 in 1.2 million. And the risk of dying in a car crash is only about 1 in 5,000, much, much lower. And yet we all get into our cars every day. And how does that compare to the fear of a vaccine injury or a serious adverse event from a vaccine? Well, the risk of an anaphylactic reaction to a vaccine is also about 1 in 1.2 million. And if you take something potentially less severe, like a hypotonic, hyporesponsive episode or pale floppy event that can happen after a DTP or pertussis containing vaccine, the risk of that happening is about 1 in 30,000. So if we look at these risks on the table, surely we should be far more afraid to get in our cars every day than we should be to get in the ocean or to have a vaccine. So what's at play here? Why do parents think the way they do? Well, our brains use heuristics or mental shortcuts to interpret what we are seeing and what we are hearing. So I'd like to take a moment to just look at some of these cognitive biases. The bias that I've just described with the shark is actually called availability bias, where we overinterpret the risk of something. We hear about an adverse event, we fear it happening to us, and we're unable to rationalise the risk. Similarly, we may, in fact, be fearful about something occurring or not understand it, and so we choose to do nothing or stick our head in the sand. Last week, I had a mum come into clinic with her two young boys, a 3.5-year-old and a 14-monther, and she was actually motivated to attend the clinic because of the no-jab policies, no jab, no pay, and no jab, no play. She was about to have her family assistance payments cut. And so she was coming to talk about, she wanted to get a medical exemption. She had vaccinated her elder child, but he had been diagnosed with autism just after his second birthday. And so she was basically coming to get a medical exemption because she had chosen completely not to vaccinate the 14-month-old younger brother because she was terrified that he would develop autism as well. But her fear about the MMR vaccine had extrapolated to all the other vaccines, and so she had chosen to do nothing. And this is called omission bias, where we fearfully avoid an action with a low risk of harm in lieu of inaction with a much greater risk of harm. So it's important for us to recognise that not acting is a form of action. We frequently see this in this scenario where parents actually confuse a temporal association of two events with causation. And lastly, there's confirmation bias, where we seek out information that confirms the beliefs that we already hold. Last year, I had an encounter with a parent who came into our immunisation clinic clutching a USB stick with the movie Vaxxed. I don't know whether many of you, can you put your hand up if you're aware of the movie Vaxxed? Right. So this was a pseudoscience documentary that was produced by Andrew Wakefield and really speaks to what he believed was the CDC's intervention into having his Lancet paper retracted and having him deregistered as a medical practitioner. This mother came in clutching the Vaxxed video on the USB and was telling me how the previous week she'd flown up to Mullumbimby to hear a talk by David Avocado Wolf in the local community hall, and how she brought her four young children in with her, and she was hell-bent on telling me how I'd been duped by science and the medical profession, and if I just watched this video, I would understand how absolutely dangerous vaccines were. It was an incredibly challenging conversation as she became extremely emotional and upset because she too also wanted a medical exemption. So what do we call this? This is confirmation bias, where we seek out information that already confirms the beliefs that we hold. And this is what parents do. They seek out information and facts that are consistent with their beliefs, and they reject facts that are not consistent with their beliefs. And I guess the challenge for us as professionals who speak with these families is how do we replace these myths, or how do we reshape their thinking in such a way that they will accept facts that are consistent with science and trustworthy sources of evidence. It's particularly worth noting that there was a publication a few years ago in 2014 by someone called Brendan Nyhan in Pediatrics, where he actually highlighted that by giving parents graphic images about vaccine-preventable diseases or just simply shoving information at them that tried to help them debunk the myth between MMR and autism actually made them more vaccine hesitant and made them less likely to immunise, and it decreased their intention to vaccinate. So there's no doubt that how we communicate pro-vaccine messages to parents is very important, it's very complicated, and it really needs to be adjusted depending on the parent that you're speaking to, their frame of reference, and their worldview. So what are some of the other factors that are driving vaccine hesitancy? I've talked about some of the mental shortcuts that parents use to interpret the world around them, but I'd like to look at some of the other factors that underpin vaccine hesitancy. I'd like to start first by telling you a story. This is a 5-year-old little girl who missed weeks of school. She had up to 4 or 5 months of coughing. She had a lot of vomiting after coughing, cracked ribs. She was extremely unwell, and of course she was diagnosed with pertussis. And this young girl is my niece, because my sister chooses not to vaccinate, and they live in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales. I don't know if they attended the talk by David Avocado Wolf or not. But this is something that is also personal for me because it's within my own family. And certainly my sister has many reasons why she chooses not to vaccinate her daughter. But certainly one of the consistent themes is that the vaccination is not consistent with her lifestyle choice, her frame of reference and her beliefs. And I think that's something that is very difficult for us to, we need to try and really connect with parents depending on their worldview. But the other issue, of course, and perhaps the most easily understandable reason why parents may choose not to vaccinate is because vaccines are a victim of their own success. Many of these diseases are just not seen anymore. We don't see diphtheria or tetanus or polio very often. But some of the vaccine-preventable diseases, of course, we do see. And, of course, the reason that many of those other diseases are so low is because we do continue to vaccinate. And overall, we can be very proud of our vaccination rates in Australia. But we do see pertussis in an epidemic year such as in 2011. There were over 40,000 cases of pertussis, and we know the most common age group is in that 4 to 9-year-old age group, and they spread pertussis within the community. But it's the under 3-monthers that die from whooping cough. Meningococcal septicemia and meningitis, a very high case fatality rate, around 10%, and a morbidity rate around 20%. A rare disease with only about 350 cases or so per year, but with devastating consequences. And this is something that we as health professionals do see. And of course, measles. There's no naturally occurring measles in Australia, but imported cases do occur. And, you know, in Melbourne, we have some of the lowest vaccine coverage rates in inner Melbourne for the 12-month time point. The vaccine coverage rate is probably around 83 to 84%. We know that we need a coverage rate around 95% to stop measles spreading in the community. So similar to the Disneyland outbreak that occurred in the US with measles in 2015, it's not going to take much for this to actually occur on our doorstep. So vaccine-preventable diseases are an ever-present danger, even though they are not visible in the same way to parents. And then lastly, I would say the influence of social media and the internet is incredibly powerful and pervasive in terms of spreading messages that make parents doubt vaccine safety. In fact, social media may actually be considered a new vehicle for bioterrorism. I don't know if many of you are aware of the article that came out last week that highlighted that Russian bots have been spreading anti-vaccine and some pro-vaccine messages, particularly within US social media sites, and as a way of infiltrating and creating doubt in parents' minds about vaccine safety, and I guess ultimately trying to sort of erode the Western way of life. But I think we need to understand just how powerful anti-vax sites are and how this information is spread so easily, obviously, on the internet. Similarly, talking about measles cases, I don't know whether you're aware, this was posted last week by WHO. So far, year to date, there have been 41,000 cases of measles in Europe, compared to just over 23,000 at the same time last year, and the year before only just over 5,000. So whether we want to acknowledge it or not, these diseases are coming back. They are, and we're part of a global community. They're only a plane ride away. So how can we convince parents or persuade parents to vaccinate their children? Well, first I'd like to share another story with you about a conversation that I recently had with a parent in clinic and how this particular conversation actually went quite well. This mum came in with her toddler and her new baby. Again, she did come into the clinic because she was after a medical exemption. She'd had her family assistance payments cut, and she really wanted to get the baby into childcare so that she could think about returning to work. She came into clinic. She was highly stressed and agitated. She'd struggled with parking. She was very flustered when she walked in the room and clearly very stressed and red in the face and sat down. I thanked her for coming and acknowledged how difficult it was for her to get there, even though she was quite late for her appointment. And I asked her to share with me what her concerns were about vaccinating her kids. Both the younger baby was completely unvaccinated. She basically highlighted that she thought children got too many vaccines in the first 2 years of life, and that she was particularly concerned about vaccine ingredients. When I pressed her on what she was concerned about with vaccine ingredients, she spoke at length about mercury and the damages and the harm that mercury can cause, and some of the ingredients in the vaccines that she had been reading about on the internet. So I carefully elicited her concerns. I allowed her to speak uninterrupted for 2.5-3 minutes, or a challenge for me because I'm a big talker. So I sat on my hands and I allowed her to speak. I tried to understand where her partner sat on this issue. I think it's very important to try and understand what both parents feel about the topic. And then I asked her if I could share with her what I knew about the topic. She was genuinely surprised to hear that there was no mercury or thimerosal in any paediatric vaccine and hadn't been since the year 2000. I went through the vaccine ingredients with her that she was concerned about. We talked about the antigens. I shared with her some of the information that we have produced in fact sheets as part of our national research collaboration called SKY, or Sharing Knowledge About Immunisation, where we've actually gone through and summarised the information on the most common concerns that parents hold, and then we have links to more detailed information should parents want them. And then at the end, I clearly made a recommendation that I thought she should vaccinate the kids and could we work together to devise a catch-up plan for the baby. And at the end of the consultation, she went out and started a catch-up plan for her young baby. Now, it doesn't always go that well, but if I share with you some of the experience from our clinic, we've done some research looking at how well we actually do with these approaches in clinic. Generally, the most highly hesitant parents, or what we call the fence sitters, we are able, and we showed from a study that we did in clinic, to get the majority of those parents to fully vaccinate. But those parents who are selectively vaccinating or cherry-picking vaccines sadly stay selectively vaccinating and cherry-picking vaccines, and we had absolutely no success with the refusers. So I don't know if that gives you some indication of where you should spend your time, but I would certainly spend over an hour with a highly hesitant parent, whereas I may only spend about 20 minutes with a clearly vaccine-refusing parent. I'm always as respectful and try to spend time, and I actively listen, but I don't put the same amount of time and energy. I leave the door open, I give them information, and I invite them to come back. So I'd like to leave you with three main things that you could consider when wondering about an approach on how to persuade a parent to vaccinate. The first is to understand that vaccine hesitancy does sit on a spectrum from accepting parents down one end all the way up to the selectively and declining parents up the other end. The research that we've done amongst different groups, parents attending general paediatric outpatients, parents in the community attending maternal and child healthcare centres, pregnant women, have shown us that about half of parents have some concerns about vaccines. About a third of those are minor concerns, and about 8 to 12% fit in that category that I described before of very highly hesitant parents or those who are selectively cherry-picking vaccines or refusing. And the second thing I would say is really we need to have effective, respectful, empathetic communication with these parents. We need to genuinely listen. When people feel heard and they relax, their cognitive biases are disengaged. By taking the time to carefully elicit their concerns, we can actually address them carefully and considerately. Considerately, I use an MI-based approach or a sort of a kind of shared decision-making approach with parents, and I use some of the fact sheets that we have developed through the SCI collaboration or those that sit on the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance, it's a bit of a mouthful, NCIRS website, or the CHOP website, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in the US. These are fantastic websites with resources that you can use to support these conversations with parents. And as I've just pointed out, understanding where the parent sits on the vaccine hesitancy spectrum can really help you to tailor your approach and your conversation. But the other important thing to recognise is that there are critical time points when parents are making decisions about vaccinating themselves and their children. And pregnancy is a critical a time point when new parents are starting to think about this information for the first time and make these decisions. We've developed this website called the Mum BubVax website, which we hope to trial nationally next year in public antenatal outpatient settings. This website's going to house information about maternal vaccines, flu and pertussis, as well as linking to the SCI website about information about childhood vaccines. And it will also have a provider-facing portal where we're going to have some training, online training webinars initially targeted at midwives to give them some vaccine communication training, because this is not easy. But essentially, the information at these critical time points, whether it's pregnancy, early in childhood, the teenage years or adult years, we need to understand that these time points are vital. With pregnancy, we need to give information early and often. We need to reassure parents carefully about vaccine safety and effectiveness, but we need to remember to pivot to the diseases and to actually remind parents about disease risk. And lastly, I think what I'm really talking about is, you know, building pro-vaccine resilient communities. We need to make vaccine acceptance the norm for parents. We need to have many positive and pro-vaccine stories out there. We need to have strong vaccine advocacy, especially in the light of any vaccine scares that occur. And we need to use social media, with sites like the Mum BubVax website, we need to encourage parents to access trustworthy information. We need to have effective communication with parents, as I've outlined, and it's really as much how we communicate with parents as what we say. We need to nurture trust in the community. We need to value acceptors and to have vaccine champions in all of our workplaces. And we need to nurture resilient children, adolescents, and adults. Vaccine hesitancy really is a pressing public health concern. And what I would say is that vaccine confidence is as, if not more important than vaccine safety and effectiveness. Because it doesn't matter how safe or effective the vaccines are, if parents won't use them. So I'd like to leave you with a quote from Roald Dahl when he was caring for his 7-year-old daughter. And some days into the illness, he wrote, "Are you feeling all right?" I asked her. "I feel all sleepy," she said. In an hour, she was unconscious, and in 12 hours, she was dead. And this is what he wrote. "There is today something that parents can do to make sure that this sort of tragedy does not happen to a child. They can insist that their child is immunised against measles." He was unable to do that in 1962 because there wasn't a reliable measles vaccine that had been discovered. Today there is a good and a safe vaccine available to every family, and all you have to do is ask your doctor to administer it. I'm sure Roald Dahl had wished that he had had a choice to immunise Olivia, as we all do. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Maggie. Thank you so much, Maggie. My mother had 9 children. She didn't immunise any of them.
Did she?
I wish she'd had a conversation with you, so it wasn't all happy outcomes. So first of all, I'm going to throw to Grace. We'll get a sense of if there are questions and comments coming from Twitter.
All right. We've only got a little bit of time, and there are so many fantastic questions from people on Twitter. Something that's come up a few times from Alex Harris-Broom and Emily Pascoe is, Other than previous anaphylaxis, is there any good grounds for medical exemption?
The medical exemption criteria are actually very strict. No, this is essentially immunocompromise and anaphylaxis are the main two medical exemption criteria at the moment. There are, of course, other reasons that we would be reluctant to immunise children, but that can be quite complicated, and we would assess that sort of on a case-to-case basis.
Fantastic. And the second one is from Ian Summers. Does no jab, no play work? If so, why? How do you overcome the influence of the power of storytelling on social media, which weaponizes temporal association and locks into the mode of N equals one causation? Do facts overcome emotions online?
That is an excellent question. Excellent question. And it's really what I was getting at. I think all we can do is have a greater presence. I think the anti-vax sites have a greater presence than the pro-vax sites. I think we need to get our message out there. We need parents to understand where credible and trustworthy information is. I do think that we can overcome the anti-vax storytelling online. It's very complicated. But I think even if you get a parent to stop and question whether that anti-vax story is correct, if you can get them to come in and speak to their healthcare provider, I think that's where the power is. As I said before, just throwing facts at parents is not going to be enough. It's about powerful communication and effective listening, I think.
Thank you very much for showing us that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maggie.